This is an iHeart podcast.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember that? It's important that we remember these things. How often do we come on here and we talk about the COVID lockdowns and things that happened in the past? They're desperate that you and me, that we just forget and let go all the things these communists have done to this country, and we're not going to let it go. And I have a bunch of sound bites for you from back then, and we have a great show for you tonight, and we're going to remember. We are going to take this and we are going to remember, because look, we're just past the year anniversary of that international embarrassment, the international disaster. I do think it's important, though, before I get to the sound bites and everything else, I think it's important we understand exactly how we got there. I think it's important that we talk about it. 9/11 happened. I was in the Marines at the time. I remember watching the towers go down from my barracks room. I just sat there and watched it live with all my Marine friends in my barracks room. And then it wasn't long after they announced there was some invasion of Afghanistan. I never went to Afghanistan, by the way. I went to Iraq. But we took over Afghanistan, kind of, a little, took over the major parts of it, could never seem to fully overcome what was going on there. And it just kept going. You remember, it just kept going on and on and on, president after president after president. It just went on and on and on. But all this time, while it was going on, I would talk to friends of mine who were still in the Marines, some Army friends of mine, Navy guys, and every one of them to a man would simply tell me, Jesse, it's a disaster. Jesse, no one knows what we're doing. Jesse, no one knows the mission. Jesse, I'm guarding the poppy fields of Afghanistan. Oh, yeah, that happened. Did you know American troops were at one point in time standing guard over the heroin? Didn't know that, did you? It was just a disaster. And then we had the Afghanistan papers. Remember the Afghanistan papers? The Afghanistan papers came out, and then the public got treated to what many of us had known all along. We went in there with no clear mission, no clear plan, and we just simply never developed one. Didn't matter who was president. Didn't matter who the generals were. It was just, hey, send some more troops and some more bombs. Hey, let's guard the poppy fields. Hey, let's build these guys a well. I bet they want clean water. A well? There was never a plan. And the plan eventually devolved into training the Afghan security forces. We're going to train them so they can take care of themselves. Look, these Taliban, they're going to try to take it back, but we're going to train and equip these Afghan security forces. And that was this long, long process. And I remember talking to my buddies about that, and they would simply laugh. There was never one kind word about the Afghan security forces. It was always, Jesse, they're a joke. Jesse, they can't stand up to anything. Jesse, they don't even want to be there. Jesse, half these guys are radical jihadists. Jesse, this sucks. It was common knowledge, and that's going to play an important part in what we're about to talk about here. It was common knowledge with everyone I talked to that Afghanistan was going to fall a half a second after we left to the Taliban. They were simply the superior military force. Superior equipment, superior tactics, superior commitment, superior everything. That's just what it was. And so Barack, or so Joe Biden takes over after Donald Trump leaves. All of a sudden, it was like it was out of nowhere. All of a sudden, Joe Biden and his team, or the people around Joe Biden, woke up one day and decided, hey, pack it up, we're leaving. Okay, boss, what about all the equipment? No, we're leaving now. All right, what about all the ISIS prisoners we have at Bagram Air Base? No, just leave them in the cells or hand them the keys. It's fine, we're leaving now. Okay, boss, what about all the American civilians that are still here? It's a dangerous country, but what are we gonna do? Oh, they'll be fine, don't worry about it. We're leaving now. And we did, we packed up, we left. And just like my buddies had told me for 20 years, took about half a second, the Taliban completely took over the country. Now you have an international humanitarian disaster because the barbarians just took over a nation. Biden administration now, they thought they were gonna look heroic, they didn't. They looked like a disaster, and the Biden administration knew they had to do something about the public image. They didn't care about any of the people, by the way, not our people, not their people, they didn't care about that, they cared about the public image. So they quickly sent our troops back in. Only we didn't have the secure airbase anymore, so our troops had to go to the public airport, just like the one in your hometown, and they had to try to secure that. Only a public airport is not made to be secured that way. So an ISIS bomber with a suicide vest on walked up to our people and blew himself up and killed 13 of our warriors that day. 13 dead because of Joe Biden. Not more complicated than that. Joe Biden, in the middle of all this, called it all an extraordinary success.
No nation has ever done anything like it in all of history. The United States had the capacity and the will and the ability to do it, and we did it today. The extraordinary success of this mission was due to the incredible skill, bravery, and selfless courage.
The gall. The extraordinary success. And do you remember when we showed you that video in the beginning of the people gathering around as we were trying to take off, and you remember there were videos out there online of people holding on to the landing gear and then falling onto their deaths. Just a horrible, horrible scene. And Joe Biden, President of the United States, finally sits down for an interview, because maybe you've forgotten, I haven't forgotten. Jen Psaki, Press Secretary, Joe Biden, and Blinken, Secretary of State, they all went on vacation during this. Remember this? International embarrassment, international disaster, and they all said, oh, I don't know. I can't cancel the beach. I won't get my Expedia refund if I do. Finally, Joe Biden saunters back in, sits down for an interview, gets asked about the international embarrassment, and Joe Biden says, what? That was a few days ago.
It took 2 days to take control of the airport. We have control of the airport now.
Still a lot of pandemonium outside the airport.
Well, there is, but look, but no one's being killed right now. God forgive me if I'm wrong about that, but no one's being killed right now. We got 1,000 somewhere, 1,200 out yesterday, a couple thousand a day, and it's increasing. We're going to get those people out.
But we've all seen the pictures. We've seen those hundreds of people packed into a C-17. We've seen Afghans falling.
That was 4 days ago, 5 days ago.
And in the middle of all this disaster, while he authored this entire thing, it all came from the White House, Joe Biden chose to throw the military under the bus.
Your top military advisors warned against withdrawing on this timeline. They wanted you to keep about 2,500 troops.
No, they didn't. It was split. That wasn't true. That wasn't true.
They didn't tell you that they wanted troops to stay?
No, not in terms of whether we were going to get out in a time frame, all troops. They didn't argue against that.
So no one told your military advisors did not tell you, no, we should just keep 2,500 troops. It's been a stable situation for the last several years. We can do that. We can continue to do that.
No one said that to me that I can recall.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan.
Yes, my assessment was back in the fall of 20, and it remained consistent throughout, that we should keep a steady state of 2,500, and it could bounce up to 3,500, maybe something like that, in order to move toward a negotiated, gated solution.
It's a simple question, Secretary Austin. He said no senior military leader advised him to leave a small troop presence behind. Is that true or not? Did these officer and General Miller's recommendations get to the president personally?
Their input was was received by the president and considered by the president, for sure.
So he just lied. But the truth is, he got 13 of our people killed. 13 of our best and brightest men and women killed. Their parents don't ever get to see them again, hug them again, don't get to surround the Christmas tree with them again. One of them, sadly, his brother just took his own life at the one-year memorial service where he lost his brother, so we might as well make it 14 at this point. Probably important to point out, after we lost our 13 brave souls, the president stepped up to the microphone looking like this.
Thank you. May God bless you all, and may God protect his troops and all those standing watch for America. We have so much to do. It's within our capacity to do it. We just have to remain steadfast. Steadfast. We will complete our mission, and we will continue after our troops have withdrawn to find means by which we can find any American who wishes to get out of Afghanistan. We will find them, and we will get them out. Ladies and gentlemen, they gave me a list here. The first person I was instructed to call on was Kelly O'Donnell of NBC.
The first person I was instructed to call on. And of course, we responded to 13 of our troops being killed. We responded by massacring 10 innocent Afghans. 7 of those were children. Nobody ever held accountable. In fact, they investigated themselves and decided no one even did anything wrong. And then the bodies of those 13 warriors were brought back home, and Joe Biden was so aggravated that he had to even show up. According to Gold Star Father Darren Hoover and others, Joe Biden checked his watch with each body that came out.
In reference to the checking of his watch, that didn't happen just once. That happened on every single one that came out of that airplane. It happened on every single one of them. They would release the salute, and he looked down at his watch on every last one, all 13, he looked down at his watch.
Joe Biden had someplace else to be. It was more important than that, I guess. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right. My friend Lee Smith is going to join us next and reflect on this horrible disaster for our country. Hang on.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
Is it a mistake, the withdrawal?
I think it is, yeah. I think the consequences are going to be unbelievably bad.
Oh, thanks, George. You're certainly who we need to turn to foreign policy advice. Joining me now is my friend Lee Smith, author of the book The Permanent Coup. How often do we talk about you being turned into an enemy of the state? Well, Lee wrote the book about it. All right, Lee. George Bush, complicated legacy, meaning it's actually crappy, but a lot of Republicans still support it. What say you?
Actually, you know, Jesse, I've been looking into that legacy. I'm writing a new book on the disgusting 50-year relationship between the United States and China. And actually, so much bad stuff happens during the two administrations of George W. Bush. It's really quite shocking. So there's Iraq, there's Afghanistan, there's the World Trade Organization, there's the financial meltdown, and all of this stuff, weirdly, it's all It's all tied to China, this really corrosive relationship. I don't mean to get us too far afield. I'm just 100% with you. Yeah, George W. Bush was a disaster. 100%. I'm just going into it, and regarding another issue, but really looking at George W. Bush, these were catastrophic years for the United States, from which the country's it'll take some work to recover from. Look, Jesse, insofar as deep state stuff, I mean, all of this stuff started to happen under George W. Bush, and you know, people like you and me, pro-America people, pro-law and order people. I don't know what you were saying, but I know the stupid stuff I was saying at the time, like, hey, don't worry about it. If you're not a terrorist, you don't have to worry about stuff like the Patriot Act. And, you know, again, I won't speak for you or for your awesome audience, but I'll speak for myself and say I was an idiot for saying such things. I should have understood things that clearer, reasonable voices, even on the left, were saying at the time about the nature of power. And now we see where these George W. Bush initiatives have led us in terms of warrantless spying. George W. Bush, what happened under George W. Bush is one of the reasons why the FBI raided the home of a former president of the United States with what is basically a general warrant, right? Which is something that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States is supposed to prevent from happening. This started post 9/11 and how America lost its head, and the person who was supposed to help us keep our head was the president of the United States, George W. Bush. So the fact that this man does not have the decency or the honor to keep his mouth shut at this point, talking about different things that he led us into, it's shameful. But that's our establishment, Jesse. Shameful people. Shameful, stupid, mendacious, and cruel.
I'm not going to let you own that all by yourself, Lee. And it's not a shock to anybody watching that I'm an idiot, but I was right there with you, young, pro-America, you know, all that stuff. Oh, shut up. It's the Patriot Act. We got to kill terrorists. You guys are stupid. Shut up, you Ron Paul nutjobs. Man, was I totally wrong, and they totally right. But anyway, I want you to actually take as much time as you need and expand on the China thing, Lee, because you're always so good about this stuff and looking into it and finding these things that people don't hear elsewhere. The floor is yours. Please, go.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at what was happening during those years, it was culminating with George W. Bush at the time. It happened under Bill Clinton. It had under George W. Bush's father, President George H.W. Bush. There was even some of it during Reagan. But of course, it starts with Nixon and Kissinger, really putting us on the road to this poisonous relationship with China. And what that looked like, I've spoken to, you know, to different servicemen from around the country. And I think it's really interesting to hear their perspective coming back from Afghanistan, coming back from Iraq, and going back to their hometowns and seeing the amount of damage that had been done by the United States, right, through the WTO, offshoring its jobs to China. People were coming back and looking looking at their communities. Servicemen were coming back and looking at their communities and like, what happened here? What did I miss? You know, a lot of these, a lot of servicemen and women, three, four, five, a whole bunch of tours, they were away for a very long period. And they came back and they're looking around at what happened. And there's a wonderful writer I have to recommend, Jesse. I don't know if you know him, a gentleman named Samuel Finley. And Sam wrote a novel, but also he writes really interesting essays for places like IM 1776. And I know you were a Marine and he was a soldier, so you might hate him for that. But he's a wonderful writer and you have to check him out. And he wrote a great piece a couple years ago just saying, yeah, you know, we came back and we're looking around and we see all these things that have gone crazy. He was in Afghanistan and he's looking at, so all these things sound terrible and we're wondering what happened to our community, what happened to our country. And then when Donald Trump comes along and says, yeah, I see the same thing, I'm going to do something about it. And that's when the attack started. He has a great way of putting it. It's something like, how dare you notice what we did to destroy you? How dare you object? How dare you complain? And that's what the war on Donald Trump is about, right? It's because it's not exclusively about Donald Trump. It's about the people who said, thank you, Donald Trump, for recognizing what happened. Now, you say you're going to do something about it, so thank you. Do something about it. I'm wandering all over the place, Jesse, but just stick with me for one second. Donald Trump, by focusing on China, he was right to focus on China, to say this is a really big issue. We've sold out our country to China. The amount of money that went over there and reflected in our trade deficit, reflected in the amount of jobs lost, the amount of pain suffered by Americans, it's just absolutely astonishing. And then you realize a large part of the financial crisis, a large part of that bailout was about helping out the Chinese who held a whole bunch of U.S. debt as well as mortgage-backed securities. The thing is, our people are the ones who got us in jeopardy with these different financial instruments. It's just amazing when you think about it. And it's George W. Bush, it's under his term that all this stuff is starting to come together. So, you know what that makes me think is, their hatred, the establishment's hatred of Trump is rational in one way. Because Trump called them hypocrites and creeps, and he knows they're liars, they wanted to be able to do these terrible things, these miserable things to the American public and get rich, and they wanted to be able to get away from it. And Donald Trump noticed. And Donald Trump said, I don't care about the excuses that you have, George W. Bush, talking about promoting democracy around the world, throughout the Middle East, spending American blood like it's cheap money to promote democracy across the Middle East. I know this wasn't about democracy. It was about something else. You people are stupid and you're cruel. And that's why they hate Trump. They hate Trump because Trump called them out. Trump called them out, not just for their failures, but for their arrogance, their vanity, what they consider their virtue and their honor. Trump said, you have no honor. You're liars. You're liars. That's what you are. And that's why George W. Bush hates Donald Trump. That's why they all hate Donald Trump. And that's why they hate Americans. Because we started to notice that, you know what? This doesn't make sense. What these guys are saying just doesn't make sense. That's why they hate us.
That was so clarifying as to what I've actually been confused why such a deep axe to grind between the Bush-Cheney faction and the Trump faction. Man, did you just sum it up well there. The book is The Permanent Coup, people. Go buy it. You will enjoy it. It's pretty revealing. Lee, thank you, my brother.
Thank you, Jesse. Appreciate you.
How about that? Lee Smith bringing the receipts and breaking it down. It does make sense, doesn't it? Trump calling them out for their viciousness. All right, we're not near done. We have a major general joining us next. What's he think about this Afghanistan stuff? Hang on.
Many of us here at the department and across the government, and millions of Americans and Afghans alike, are mindful of today's meaning as the 20-year-long U.S. military mission in Afghanistan ended nearly 1 year ago. Ending the longest war in American history was never going to be easy. But 1 year later, we are in a stronger position as a country because of the president's decision.
That seems like a lie. Joining me now, Major General Jeffrey Schlosser, U.S. Army retired, former commanding general of the 101st Airborne Division, which is freaking cool. Also author of the book Marathon War. General, are we better off than we were a year ago?
I don't think we're safer, Jesse, for sure. And, so we got credit for getting out of the world's, our longest war, ever in our history. But are we safer? Are Americans safer? I don't think so. I mean, I could give you several examples, but think about, I think Americans know that we just killed Zawahiri in Kabul. He was living right next to the guest house of the interior minister for the Taliban government, who is a Haqqani, which I know you know is a terrorist guy, and he's the interior minister. So that doesn't make me feel safer. We were able to reach out. There's no doubt that we were able to reach out to him. But I really wonder, if he was there, what about all the minions that we can't track? What about the terrorist camps that we don't know about? it goes on and on and on. And Jesse, I don't feel safer, and I don't think my grandkids are safer after this.
General, I want to ask about just, I know it's a detail part of this, but I mean, you were a commanding general and I most definitely was not, so you would know and I wouldn't. All the equipment we left behind, that was such a hot talking point at the time for myself and others, and I'm still staggered by that. I mean, we left them Black Hawks and NVGs and secure comms. That seems like such a, and I know this isn't a word, an unmilitary way to get out. How does something like that happen?
I just have to say that I think we were the precipitous withdrawal, the hasty withdrawal, the somewhat unplanned, I would say, withdrawal left a large amount of equipment, as you said, Jesse, and as we've talked about before. You know, I just want to also point out that there was a report, you know, and just this last week from the Congress that some amount of the equipment went with Afghan commandos and special forces into Iran. Iran's no friend of the United States, and there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to take a hard look at not only the skill sets that those Afghan commandos had, because we trained them, and the special forces, but then also the equipment that they took along with them over into Iran. I mean, right now you see, and I said this before, I think on your show, is that, you know, the Taliban went from a pretty not well-equipped insurgent force to a pretty darn well-equipped national force for whatever you want to call their Islamic emirate. You know, they've got a lot of equipment. As you said, they've got aircraft. Probably more importantly, they've got things like mortars and artillery, more small arms than any country that of this nature would normally have, and they got ammunition. And then they got some great bases. We built them the bases, we left them, and we just we departed. I don't think that this was intentional. I think we made huge errors. Well, if it was intentional, it was a rigged mistake, as you've already pointed out.
General, what's the right way to go about it? Okay, we're leaving. President orders everyone out. You got to do what you're told. But you're given a little bit of a time frame. What's the appropriate way? Do you destroy all that stuff? You load it all up on a plane? How do you make sure this doesn't happen?
Yeah. Well, here was the problem. I'm not making excuses for anybody, but, the whole plan from the previous administration had been that it was conditions based. And the truth is this administration chose in April of 21 that it would be unconditional. So there were no conditions on the Taliban. And meanwhile, the Afghans, they're asking to, you know, hey, look, stay here as long as you possibly can. They weren't a part of any detailed part of that diplomatic negotiation between the Taliban and the administration of the United States, nor was NATO, nor was our largest ally in the country, the Afghan or the UK. So this all happens within a space of about 3 or 4 months. You don't have enough time to ship it out of there. And so you end up destroying a large amount of it. We obviously didn't do that. Part of the reason, and from what I understand from my friends that are still on active duty, were on active duty then, is the intent was to try to make sure that it all transferred to the Afghan army. Did they plan that the Afghan army would fold and give this stuff right over to the Taliban.
China. China is not talked about enough when it comes to Afghanistan and their role in Afghanistan. What is their role? Are they stepping in?
Oh, absolutely. I have to remind all our citizens that China actually abuts part of Afghanistan. It's not a huge border, but it's up there in the northeast. But they are, have a border there. I got to go all the way back, Jesse, to the time, when I wrote my book there and when I was in command of the 101st and Regional Command East in 08 and 09. The Chinese made a deal with Afghan businessmen to buy one of the largest copper mines still extant in the world there in my sector of Afghanistan. It wasn't operated, hadn't been operated for a generation. The Chinese concept was they were going to come in, put their laborers into that mine. The Afghans were going to secure the mine. And oh, by the way, American troops, because they were mined, were supposed to secure the outer part of this copper mine. It never went, but this is still something that they want to do. You're going to see them continue to try to build a rail line into Afghanistan. There's everything from copper to rare earths to lithium. It goes on and on and on. It's a $1 trillion potential for the Chinese. And they are, just like they're in Africa, Jesse, they're going into Afghanistan. But I'm not talking the future. I'm talking now.
What do they want out of Africa?
They want rare earth. They want all the different commodities, access to those commodities that they can extract, which is what they're going to do, and take it back to China. And meanwhile, what they do is what they want is this relationship where they are the they own a good part of everything that they develop, whether it's a port in Africa, whether, you know, something of that nature, Eritrea, Ethiopia, it goes on and on and on the list. But they want it so that they have an ability to say to that country, you're going to vote with us in the United Nations. And oh, by the way, when we want to do a port visit, we're going to come to you. And if we want to put troops in Africa for some reason, we're going to come to you as well. And so, you know, this is a client relationship. They've invested billions and billions of dollars in African countries, not only to extract from it, but also to have that political, military, security aspect as well. They're, you know, this is part of their Belt Road, basically, the New Silk Road. But it's meant to actually tighten up around the United States, to be honest, and pressure us.
Okay, switching gears back to Afghanistan, I have friends I trust who are still serving, and they've told me several times, we brought some bad actors back to the United States of America when we did that rushed refugee withdrawal. Have you heard things like this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can't verify that we in fact did that, but the potential is extraordinarily high. I mean, Jesse, let's remember, we brought back 120,000 Afghans. And some of them were vetted really, really closely and took months upon months to ever get to the United States. Others got here a little bit faster than that. I'm not sure we know exactly, what they're doing, what their background is. There's no doubt that some are criminals. There's just no doubt about it. There could be some folks that are actually, terrorists in waiting. We should be prepared for that. I think the large amount of people, the large amount of number of Afghans just want to have a better life. But we have definitely got to be on alert, for any potential criminal or terrorist. I mean, I know a lot of us paid attention to the killing of four Muslim men in Arizona a couple of weeks ago. And I do believe that there's going to be an Afghan connection there. It's not going to be one of the people that just recently came, though, from Afghanistan. It's something longer lived and probably within the community there.
John Kirby had something interesting, horrible, depending on your perspective, interesting to say about Afghanistan. Here it was.
Do you have any announcements in terms of any punishments, judicial punishments, for those who were responsible for the drone strike?
I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike. What we saw here was a breakdown in process, an execution in procedural events, not the result of negligence, not the result of misconduct, not the result of poor leadership.
General, we drone strike 10 innocent people in response to their terrorist attack, and not one person was held accountable. There was no negligence. You were the general, I was a corporal. Does that pass the smell test to you?
Yeah, don't forget, Jesse, I was a private first class when I came in too, so I still believe in accountability at all levels, from private all the way up to general. I mean, Kirby, I don't know, he that wasn't one of his most glib moments for sure. If it's in fact the case that there has been nothing, no one held accountable for killing 10 innocent people, in fact, to remind everybody, the person that we were targeting actually worked for a California not-for-profit trying to feed Afghans. I mean, a horrible event. Accountability should take place. I think, you well know. I mean, I ended up retiring. I chose to retire to ensure I was being held accountable for my actions in Afghanistan as far as the death of 9 great airborne soldiers in a really tough fight. So I do believe in accountability. I've not read that report. I think a lot of it still is classified. But to state blanket like that no one's going to be personally held accountable, I don't think is the right way to go. And I think that it's shameful for the United States not to look really, really hard at what broke down. And then it wasn't mechanical. The processes are done by people.
Well, General, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Absolutely, Jesse. Take care. Good to be on the show.
One person was held accountable for Afghanistan. He was the one who said someone should be held accountable for Afghanistan. Lieutenant Colonel Scheller, we're going to talk to him next.
Did any of you throw your rank on the table and say, hey, it's a bad idea to evacuate Bagram Airfield, the strategic air base, before we evacuate everyone? Did anyone do that? And when you didn't think to do that, did anyone raise their hand and say, we completely messed this up? Potentially all those people did die in vain if we don't have senior leaders that own up and raise their hand and say, we did not do this well in the end. I want to say this very strongly. I have been fighting for 17 years. I am willing to throw it all away to say to my senior leaders, I demand accountability.
Joining me now, a man I consider to be a patriot above pretty much all the daggone generals and admirals out there, Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Scheller, veteran, discharged after that, by the way, and author of the book, Crisis in Command. Colonel, one, semper fi to you, sir. Two, how deep is the rot on the upper levels of our military? Because I have to tell you, Colonel, the things my friends tell me who are still in, none of them have a single good word to say about the flag officers, and that is a very bad thing.
Jesse, thanks for having me on. I'll start with the junior enlisted. Junior officers are still some of the best in the world. I still think if we had the correct leadership that we could go anywhere and do anything. But to your point, our senior leaders have become people-pleasing. They lack the moral courage that we need, and the rot is pretty deep. It starts with accountability by us as Americans signaling that winning wars is important, that accomplishing the political objectives that we are willing to sacrifice junior service members for is important. But until we can do that, we're going to continue to repeat the same mistakes we've made since really Vietnam. So important that we all take a look at the fundamental issues within the military.
Colonel, can you explain, I mean, as someone who was obviously once a junior officer and worked your way up to lieutenant colonel, which is no small feat, how does that happen when you get up to, like Billy? Billy's a great example. I'm not asking you to call him out personally, but the dude has a list of ribbons and medals stacked that high. From what I understand, in his younger years, was certainly downrange and a warrior, and now is a political lackey. How did that happen?
In the military, your evaluation is completely subjective. So you have to please your boss. It's not based on warfighting skill. There may be some carryover because you might have a boss along the way that thinks warfighting skill is the most important, but you're also gonna have other bosses that think annual training and the initiative of the day over warfighting capability is the most important. So to get up to four-star general, you have to develop into a people-pleasing person. We need to overhaul the promotion system. We need to take a hard look at the time required to make a four-star general. Because, yeah, Milley, when he was a young officer like the rest of us, probably came in for idealistic reasons, but he got off course, career-minded, career-focused, career progression, and that's what happened. You get these guys that are willing to do whatever it takes to please the political flavor at the time at the expense of protecting our service and protecting the ideals that Americans should stand for.
You made that video, and I have a hard time believing, you and I haven't talked before, but I have a hard time believing you just did that on a whim, right? You had to know there was going to be some heavy heat coming your way for making it. Why make it?
Yeah, I didn't go into that day knowing I was going to make the video, but if you go back and watch it, I stayed in the video. I knew I was risking my job, my retirement, my family stability. But because this is something that I've lived and breathed for my entire life, I've developed a deeper appreciation. I knew no senior leaders were going to be held accountable. I knew that we were going to try and weaponize the media and talk about what a success it was. And I'll tell you, as we're coming up to the anniversary, no one is taking away from the sacrifices of those junior service members that got put in a terrible position. They did everything they could, and junior service members always rise to the occasion. But this is bigger than that. This is a systemic failure that really a light was shown on it. When we saw how bad the Afghanistan evacuation was planned, there was just no coherent thought, there was no foresight, and there was no senior military leaders advising, which is their role to do so. And so I went into that day, and I made a choice. I made a choice that our service members needed accurate, timely assessment of failure. And that's what validates their sacrifices, not all these other deflections and telling us that we did well. If we know we're gonna just remain in the system that isn't looking out for our welfare. I just felt like All the service members needed an honest assessment, and I felt like I was the closest thing to it.
What happened to you after the video?
It got weird. So immediately after posting it, I was fired, I was ridiculed, I was bullied, and I had to make a choice, right? So the hardest argument is everyone agrees with the statements in the first video, and then I continue to make statements, and people are like, why did you continue to make statements? The truth was, I knew what my future was. They already told me I was moving to Quantico, I was gonna sit in a cubicle, I was gonna wait further legal action. I'm sure they'd try to convince me that I had some type of PTSD and that I was a victim and that they were gonna take care of me and I could limp towards my retirement for the next 3 years. And I just couldn't live my life like that. I knew the statements I had made were correct. I had no one addressing the content. And I knew that this was important. We're at an inflection point in America. And so I doubled down, I continued to make statements, I violated the gag order. And I ultimately ended up in solitary confinement, but I never apologized. I took accountability for the rules that I did break, but my senior leaders are still shirking their responsibilities, and not a single one of them has come forward and said, I messed this up, which was the point I made in my first video.
Okay, how do we fix it, Colonel? Because look, Americans love their military, especially their Marine Corps. God love them for that. They love it. They don't want to see it turn into what it's turning into now and what it's turning into quickly, especially when you look at recruiting numbers, the real pipe hitters retiring. It's really, really bad where we're going. How do we stop it?
So I outlined it in the book. To your point, accountability just addresses the failure. It doesn't fix the systemic problems. I end the book with a 13-point punch card of do these things now, we can get the military back on track. But there is no simple fix. It's taken us a long time to get in this mess, and it's gonna take a while to get out of it, but it starts with putting in senior leaders that have the courage to, one, address the failures, and two, make the changes that are required.
Colonel, Afghanistan, obviously it's gone now, the Taliban own it. You were there. What do you make of all that?
You know, I explore my thoughts in the book. Afghanistan was one of those things where we could have declared victory multiple times. In the early gambit of the war, Task Force 58 could have enveloped the Tora Bora region and killed Osama bin Laden. General Mattis was commanding that unit. Rumsfeld had misguided restraint. But then we started a war on a second front in Iraq. And then even later, when General Mattis was a CENTCOM commander, when we killed Osama bin Laden, we had a chance to achieve political objective and pull out. The Taliban was never a terrorist organization. They were a conventional army. We drove them into Pakistan. The only terrorist was Al-Qaeda that was operating within the government of the Taliban. So this whole war on the global war on terrorism after we destroyed Al-Qaeda in the initial stages became about the military industrial complex. I mean, you look at General Dunford now, he's on the Lockheed Martin board. You look at General Mattis, he went from General Dynamics to Secretary of Defense back to General Dynamics. You look at our current Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, he went from Raytheon to the Secretary of Defense. These long protracted wars are good for business, and these senior military leaders are staying a part of it just so that they can cash out on these oligopoly of government contracting firms, and no one's doing what they really need to do to increase our national power and achieve the political objectives that our politicians set for the war.
Colonel, the book is Crisis in Command. Colonel, I appreciate you, sir.
Thanks, Jesse.
All right, we'll be back. For final thoughts, we're going to do something we should do often. We are going to read the names and remember the names of the 13 lost, because they deserve to be remembered. Here they are. Army Staff Sergeant Ryan Noss, Marine Corps Corporal Humberto Sanchez, Marine Corps Corporal Hunter Lopez, Marine Corps Lance Corporal Riley McCollum, Marine Corps Lance Corporal Dylan Marola, Marine Corps Corporal Dagan William Tyler, Marine Corps Sergeant Giovanni Rosario, Marine Corps Lance Corporal Jared Schmitz, Navy Corpsman Max Soviak, Marine Corps Lance Corporal David Espinoza, Marine Corps Sergeant Nicole Gee, Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Darren Taylor Hoover, Marine Corps Lance Corporal Kareem Nakau. Semper Fi, warriors, rest in peace. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.